I would like to introduce Ella. I'm really happy to introduce her because I've been like, you know, always organized by some fun people. So I'm really happy to hear Ella's thoughts on this, like for the coming like 15 minutes. So Ella, please go ahead.
I'll try to keep this to just 50 minutes. So for those of you who don't know me, my name is Elmar Saita. I wear a bunch of different hats. I'm technical director at the International Modern Media Institute out of Iceland. I'm principal security engineer at the Open Internet Tools Project. I work on the Briar decentralized delay-tolerant messaging platform and the Trike threat modeling tool and do a bunch of other random things in my spare time. And today I'm here to talk about kind of, well, the stuff that's floating around in the air and surveillance and the interaction between surveillance and the state and the people. I want to start by saying that this is actually a lot bigger than sort of our current moment and the worries about, oh, which government is doing this to these people and what are the technical capabilities and kind of all of the stuff that has been organizing the part of, or that has been taking up the time and the part of this story that isn't just turned into a soap opera set in a Russian airport. What this actually is, and I guess it's worth understanding as we go into this, why the different sides think the way they do and what the mindsets that are playing into this battle are. And that's where we start seeing this kind of long-term structure. What we're actually looking at right now is what you could call kind of a battle between good and evil. But it's not a battle between good and evil in this kind of like titanic clash of the evil spies versus the good freedom fighters. What it actually is a battle in terms of how we understand humanity. Do we understand people as fundamentally good, or do we understand people as fundamentally evil? And this is one of these sort of like epic philosophical debates that we normally think of as not having that much relevance to, you know, kind of the real world, to the way, you know, to everyday life. But it turns out to actually have a lot of relevance. So if you believe in democratic free societies and think that they are very, very important and things that absolutely must be preserved, that, you know, our ability to be humane to each other depends on the existence of a democratic society, but you believe that people are fundamentally evil, what do you do? So there is an entirely consistent and coherent mindset that says people are fundamentally evil. Democratic society is an amazing and beautiful and scarce and rare flower that must be preserved no matter what. However, democratic society cannot be exposed to the evils of people in the real world, because if it is, it will fail, it will fall apart, it will die. If you believe that, you should get a job at the CIA, because that is the mindset that drives mass surveillance, in kind of Western democratic regimes, where there's this understanding that, yes, democracy is important. Democracy is too important to be left undefended. Democracy requires rough men doing evil deeds in the night to preserve the space in which it can happen. And the people who are practicing that democracy can never find out what was done in the name of that democracy, or they won't be able to do the thing that they're doing. Their innocence has to be retained, lest they be tainted, lest they be corrupted. If you think that people are fundamentally good, then your life is in some ways much simpler, because you don't have to worry about people being tainted by the reality of things. You can simply assume, well, if we build these structures that let people coordinate and collaborate, things will probably work out okay. You know, they may go a bit off course sometimes, but we don't need that structure in the dark. And probably further, you would say that the democratic structures and our ability to have this kind of, you know, peaceful, beautiful flower of democracy or what have you depend on those things not happening. This is the battle that we're actually looking at right now. Now, let's look at a bit more about what good and evil actually are. I don't think anyone who is approaching this, you know, certainly, you know, like the folks at the CIA, I don't think that they think that the North Koreans are an elemental evil. But what they do believe is that if you are, if you believe that, that most people are like you, and most people do, and you are selfish and you want the people who are more like you to do better in the world, then you assume that everyone else is doing the same thing. And all evil means is, oh, you're someone over there who's coming from a very different position than I am. You want different things and we're, that are mutually hostile. Whereas if you believe that people are fundamentally altruistic, this is, you know, and don't want other groups to do better than they are, this is the same thing as, in some ways, saying that people are fundamentally good, then, again, you don't need to kind of fight and try and undermine those people. This kind of economic balance and economic understanding of altruism and differential benefit are going to underlay a lot of the things that I have to say today, so I'm going to come back to this theme a bit. But another reason of why these people surveil, it's not like they just said, well, you know, this has to happen in the world, so therefore I'm going to go do surveillance on behalf of the state. You know, we did actually ask them to do this surveillance. You know, there's budget items that say, oh, you know, please run a surveillance agency. Here is however much money to do it. And the reason why we all collectively ended up asking those people to do it, in many cases many years ago, and that's just kind of continued, is that geopolitics, like if you're trying to run a nation state as a nation state, geopolitics is the law of the strong. You know, there is this notion that there is international law and that, that, you know, you can somehow like, oh, you invaded me, so I'm going to sue you. No, it doesn't work that way, or at least historically it hasn't worked that way. This isn't to say that we can't have structures that aren't the law of the strong at the geopolitical level, but we don't have them right now. So nation states require this kind of surveillance in order to function. The modern state depends on having an intelligence function. Now, and clearly I should be clear that this is not to excuse the intelligence function I'm saying this. It's to understand what the set of power relationships are here. And I would actually say that the state depends on having an intelligence function because the state depends on being able to deny others access to territory. Now, if you're in a globalized situation where state borders are porous, where people flow back and forth, where ideas flow back and forth, where trade flows back and forth, you can't simply build a wall. Certainly before World War I, and even in the lead up to World War II, there was this kind of notion at the diplomatic level of gentlemen do not open each other's mail. You know, that you didn't need to do, you shouldn't do this kind of deep, dirty intelligence work. But as the world has become more globalized, as the world has become more porous, the need perceived from the state side to do surveillance has grown because they don't have any other way of understanding and controlling the state structure. As the state structure becomes in some ways flimsier, the need for, you know, it has to hang on more to be able to maintain the same centralizing governance structure. So one of the things that I hear a lot as people are trying to deal with, sometimes psychologically but also technically, the outcome of the massive pile of revelations that's been dumped in our lap, well, revelations and confirmations, which doesn't seem likely to end anytime soon, thankfully. One of the things that I hear people saying is we need to make policy, we need to ensure that these things don't happen anymore without oversight, which I think is a great idea. It's sadly kind of ridiculous. Policy doesn't matter around surveillance for a few reasons. If you look at the historical record of surveillance structures, we've never seen a modern state without going through a revolution or something similar roll back deployed operational and technical capabilities. Once something is fielded from an intelligence gathering team, assuming it stays funded, if it is in the field, if it is working, and if it is actually producing useful intelligence, it stays there, pretty much no matter what, as far as we can tell. The NSA did very politely in 1975 turn off their telegram surveillance program. It had never in, you know, their entire history produced anything useful. So that's our one example of technological capability being rolled back. So much for history. Also, if you build a capability, limiting it similarly doesn't work, because there's this sort of notion of pernicious efficiency, right? If you have a functional system that's deployed and it's useful for one thing, oh, we could use that for that too. Oh, we could use that for that too. And the capability just kind of naturally expands over time. It's very difficult because policy doesn't have enough of a hold on things. You know, as soon as policy weakens for a moment, oh, we need it over here too. You know, there's always something else you could do with that capability. Policy relies on political enforcement. If you can't politically enforce your policy, then you have very little likelihood of it being functional in the long term. Now, I don't know about GCHQ and the Germans and the Dutch, but NSA taps every politician's email. Anybody who might become a politician, they tap their phones, they tap their email. Partially, they do this for national security reasons. They need to know, you know, if those people are, you know, have sold out to somebody. Or, I mean, there's any number of justifications, right? But it also means that they have all the dirt on all the politicians. Now, how easy do you think it is to keep a politician bot if their career can be destroyed at any moment? You know, how well do you think that long-term policy will is going to be when they know that if they stand up too much, they just get destroyed? Clean politicians don't win elections. You know, clean politicians aren't allowed to win elections, but also there just aren't clean people in the world, you know. Everybody has something that's embarrassing enough to ruin their career if NSA decides they want to ruin someone's career over it. And also, really, policy doesn't matter because policy isn't the level at which these decisions are made. These decisions are made at kind of milito-economic terms, purely. The economics of spying is the structure that controls whether or not spying is done. The notion of return on investment is very germane here. How much intelligence product am I going to get for a given investment? That is what determines which intelligence methods are used. Now, compliance with legal structures is a cost in this case, right? If I decide that I don't want to comply with a legal structure, I may have to budget so much extra for, you know, getting the right politician elected, or so much extra for getting the law changed, or buying the creation of a secret court, or whatever the thing that I need to swing my weight around to do is. But if you're looking from a purely economic perspective, it's really just a cost to roll out some new spying technology. You know, you can assign a dollar value to how much it's going to take to push that through. And if you decide that the cost-benefit analysis is worth it, then maybe you change the societal structure, the legal structure, to allow you to do the piece of intelligence work that you think is necessary. Political fallout, similarly. This is just a minimizable cost structure over time. So your primary target is intelligence product per dollar, but you're also interested in coverage, right? Having really deep intelligence in one area isn't particularly interesting if you're an intelligence company. You need both deep intelligence in specific areas, but also the understanding that you have a broad spectrum. You also need flexibility. You don't know what your intelligence needs are going to be next week. So this leads you to look very aggressively at things like full-take surveillance, because full-take surveillance means that you have maximum amount of flexibility. You can decide at any point where you want to go deep. You can decide 5 years later that you needed to go deep somewhere else. Cost is an interesting structure in here because the risk, and this is the mindset shift that happened at least in the U.S., really, it happened throughout the kind of black state, throughout the intelligence world in the Cold War, where all of a sudden an intelligence failure became an existential risk. You know, it was a thing that was literally intolerable because if you fail, everyone in the country might die. So at that level, there is no cost, which is too great. Now, there's what cost you can actually afford to spare versus the other things you need to do with that money, but there's never a level where you've overspent on intelligence if it's usefully preventing that existential failure. 9/11 in the U.S. was another instance of this. It was another case where it suddenly became an existential crisis, and completely reoriented the intelligence community in the U.S. In the early 90s, the director of the NSA and the director of the CIA refused to talk to each other. They literally could only communicate through intermediaries because the interorganizational hatred was that deep. That vanished in a few months. This is very interesting if you're looking at what this balance looks like. But the fact that, you know, it's still fundamentally about return on investment, which is really good for us, it turns out, because we can shape the market of their return on investment, or rather we can shape their cost structure for different kinds of intelligence work. You know, there's a few reasons why they do take some actions which don't make any economic sense. Graft, you know, oh, my buddy has a company that does X. Oh, yeah, we totally need that. You know, political stability is an interesting one. Even if they're not actually going to, you know, even if it's an entirely internal, oh, there are these activists, we don't like what they're doing, the government might change on us. If you're NSA, you don't want the government to change, not because it's going to necessarily be an existential event for the country, but because you don't want, you know, any kind of instability. It's just bad for business. So you end up going after a whole range of dissidents who maybe aren't so important for, you know, deep intelligence reasons, but matter in terms of the political stability. And then also one of the other non-economic structures is that NSA's first priority isn't the survival of America, it's the survival of NSA. Which means that if you look at it purely from the external cost per intelligence product return on investment, they do things which don't make sense because they're actually aimed not at the survival of the US, but the survival of NSA. And this the same applies to any other intelligence organization. I'm using NSA for the examples because it's sort of the most temporal one, but regardless, ROI still kind of fundamentally rules. So the intelligence or the security community, if you evaluate them from this kind of perspective, has been doing a lot of really weird stuff over the last 20 or 30 years, a lot of which doesn't make any sense. We have a lot of really great math, very little of which ends up resulting in keeping people secure in the field. There's this sort of, you know, truism in the community. Well, everything is broken, right? You know, if you have an Android phone, well, okay, we can't secure how code is delivered to the phone, and SSL is broken, and we know there's all sorts of bugs in the operating system, and the baseband is completely owned, and the SIM toolkit, and it, you know, and we don't know, and the hardware is manufactured on untrusted assembly lines, and, you know, so there's just really nothing we can do. Everything is owned. This is not actually that relevant in the real world, because what we actually care about isn't, is something secure theoretically, it's, did someone get away with the thing that they were trying to do? And this was, I mean, I spent 9 years as a commercial consultant thinking about security mostly from that mindset of, you know, what is the kind of theoretical structure of, can I trust this thing? And then I started spending more time in the field and very quickly realized, no, I don't really care what the theory is. I care, did my friend get away from the police? You know, and sometimes that's, you know, were they able to kind of maintain some sort of long-term subterfuge? And sometimes it's, did they have the 5 minutes that they needed to make it to the airport? And when you look at the world from this kind of outcome-oriented perspective, it, among other things, plays very well with this understanding of intelligence as return on investment, because that's the same game, right? It's not, could theoretically this dragnet have picked up some piece of intelligence? It's, did it? Was it actually useful? So the things that we need to focus on to shift the structure of intelligence gathering, the things that we can possibly achieve, are stopping this kind of full take, we're just going to surveil everything coming across this cable surveillance, and protecting the social graph. Because those are the two things that are most deleterious to free society and where we have the most leverage. based on the current situation. SMTP is a really interesting example of this. By default, SMTP between two servers is unencrypted. So you may have an encrypted connection from your mail client, whether that's webmail or a thick client that's running on your laptop, to the mail server. But then that mail server talks to another mail server where your friend has their mail service somewhere across the internet. And that connection across the backbone is completely unencrypted, which is why NSA is able to just snoop up most of that mail, because it's just sitting there right on the wire. Now, so there's two kinds of encryption for email. You can either require that connections between two mail servers always be encrypted, which is very difficult to roll out because most mail servers don't support it right now. However, if everyone starts saying, well, if the other guys, you know, I'll ask first if the other guy supports encryption, and then we'll upgrade to that, this actually buys you a massive amount. If an intelligence agency or anyone else who can get between those servers wants to make an active attack, they can still get the mail. It's very easy to just fake that the other server said no. But that's noticeable. And they have to actually do something on the wire, right? That's not something that is passive. And revealing active intelligence capabilities in a context like that is very expensive. You can't do that. If NSA decided that, oh, we're just going to man in the middle every mail connection at once, people would notice. It would be a diplomatic problem globally. It's no longer this kind of quiet surveillance place that they need to be coming from. So even without providing any additional theoretical security, because, well, of course it can be downgraded, we've completely shifted the outcome. We've completely shifted the return on investment for doing that kind of passive snooping. And, you know, there are a lot of different places where we can do that, make that same kind of shift. This is interesting when you're looking at designing security systems. You know, did you get caught? Could you perform the mission? And did you see the failures and correct for them? Are equally important questions. The only one of those that is directly influenced by the kind of math of security is, did you get caught? The rest of those are entirely usability questions. And the did you get caught is actually informed as much around operational security practices. Does the user understand how the tool is supposed to work? You know, can they actually use the tool correctly? All of these other questions. Security is actually, in many ways, mostly a usability problem. Certainly, the usability part of it is at least as hard as all of the rest of it. We've concentrated on theory to such a degree that it has actually completely warped our ability to understand what the actual problems we're trying to solve are. Part of this is because the security community doesn't have any real problems. It's a bunch of white guys who can afford to spend time hanging out in tents in the middle of the very nice Dutch countryside. You know, which is great, it's awesome, but it means that you don't understand the position of someone who's in the field, of someone who's actually depending on this tool working for whether or not they and their cousin who barely knows how to use a computer survive the night. And once you put yourself in those shoes, you start looking at the tools we build in a very, very different way. And I don't blame people for having the standpoint from which they come from. I mean, that's just like it happens. But it's time to start expanding our viewpoint on the world. So I want to try and give you guys some hope about the future, even though everything is broken. Encrypting all the things isn't enough. So encrypting all the things will be hard, but it isn't actually enough. However, there are things that we can do that will actually make a real difference in addition to encrypting all the things. If we start decentralizing all the things, that makes a real difference. One of the reasons why NSA has been so successful is that, well, if we can't break your security or if it's going to be too inconvenient to tap this on the wire, we'll just show up with a letter. And now you have to do what we say. And, you know, there's lots of other places where this can happen too. We don't know as much about who else is trying to compel companies to do that, but I would guarantee that if NSA is doing it, lots of other people are doing it as well. If you have to physically take a hard drive out of the machine to get at my data, and my data is on a server somewhere in you know, a rack that's who knows where, run by another company, so you don't have to talk to me to get at that machine, then I never find out about it when you take that hard drive. If I own the rack that it's running in, then maybe you have to talk to me, or maybe you can just talk to the people who run the colo. But still, I'm a little bit better off. At least, you know, somebody's going to, like, hey, wait, why did this machine go down? You know, I have some visibility in there. If that hard drive is in my pocket, you're going to have a relatively difficult time of taking it without my knowledge. So decentralization, when you do not have the rule of law as a protective structure, which we don't, is an incredibly, incredibly critical tool. This means that we need to stop using an internet that is built out of services. APIs are counter-revolutionary. It's over. We need to stop relying on central services. We just can't do it anymore. It is impossible to build a free internet that is centralized. But we can't just say, well, okay, we're going to build a bunch of protocols and then everyone will decide to use them, because, you know, if it hasn't worked so far, why should it work now? Because that's a really sexy app. But I'm going to be, you know, it's not, you can't just tell people, yeah, we don't have a, we do have a moral high ground, but it's not enough, right? You know, we're doing a lot better this week than we were a few months ago as far as being able to say, no, really, guys, it's important, this matters, you need to do this, but it's still not enough. So we don't just need protocols, we need protocols with business models. We need some way of being able to say, okay, yes, this development pays for itself. We have the money to hire a real UX team and real designers and a marketing team and all of the other things that you do in the commercial world if you're actually serious about building software. Because it turns out that programming is the easy part. Everything else is the hard part. Adoption is harder than development. Design is harder than feature completeness. That's the part that we don't have right now that we have to learn and kind of learn in a hurry. And honestly, the user model is the thing that needs to come first. Because, you know, let's say I release a web chat client and it's really easy to use and people love it and the software and the security really sucks. Well, you know what? Turns out we can fix that. We can totally fix that, and it doesn't matter where it started, because you know what? People are actually fucking using it, and that's the part that actually matters. And they can use it. And we can do, like, if we start with the user model, if we start with, okay, this is the security primitives that we're trying to provide, and we know how to do them, and we know how to explain them to the user, and we know why they're interesting, and we can make them cool and fun, whatever. We'll fix the math later, you know. And we're trying to get better at being able to do that process. There's a few projects I'm trying to run, which I can tell you about later if you're interested, but, you know, that where we can take something that makes sense and is a tool that can ship and will work in the real world and get it to the point where it needs to be deployed in a high-risk environment. But it has to make sense first. You have to start with design. So I know there's a bunch of people here who work in NGO land. I am one of them. And I'm going to speak to a few different groups here. NGO land, we have a problem. We are concerned about building careers. We are concerned about our space. We are concerned about the security scene. Fuck all that. What we are supposed to be doing is trying to solve the problems. And this is, you know, different organizations get this and different organizations don't. It's not universal. But I see a lot of people in the field, which I just kind of walked into, and I'm just going to be the bull in the china shop thrashing around for a while. I see a lot of people who are doing things that don't really look like trying to solve the problem, because they're like, I know what trying to solve problems looks like, and it's not, well, you know, this isn't really the project that we should be doing, but it's what we think we can get funded, maybe, and it's not, well, we don't actually know if it's going to have any real, I mean, yes, I understand that we have to deal with funders, but if the funders won't fund the products that are, or the projects that are going to make a real impact, then let's fucking talk to the funders and get them to change what the hell they fund, because we can do that. This is ridiculous. We cannot keep wasting time and money on dumb projects that look really cool and, you know, get us respect within the community but don't actually help people on the ground. you know, I don't want to see help desks that are run without people who are have the depth of skill to actually help the people that they're helping. That doesn't do any good, you know. And there's a billion other examples. That's just one off the top of my head. Security people, hackers, we also have a problem. We have massive fucking egos. They're getting in the way. I don't care about your ego. My friend Zineb, who is trying to keep her 7-year-old daughter from getting the shit beaten out of her by Moroccan riot cops, does not care about your egos. When I don't have any tools, because I get told that, oh yeah, GPG is totally something that you can teach people in the field, fuck you. And it, the egos don't matter. Like, if you do a cool thing, everybody's going to get, hey, you did a cool thing. That's really awesome. Let's go do other cool things together. You know, we... there are enough of us that if we work together, we can do some pretty amazing shit if we work together. If we all, like, dick wave, we can't do anything useful. You know, and this goes for, like, I mean... so I've been around in the security community for a while, and I can do the whole, you know, oh, that's an idea. Your idea sucks. My idea is better, just as well as anyone. It's not useful. Let's stop trying to harass each other instead of just having polite technical conversations like professionals do in the real world. You know, this is a crisis, not a career. We don't have time to play those games anymore. One of the other things, and this is interesting for a lot of projects, I see a lot of stuff getting built without a theory of change, this is a cool tool that I can build without any understanding of, hey, there's a larger battle going on. How does this change the overall landscape? Where is this going? What am I actually trying to do? So, here's an interesting little example. Right now, we have systems that are incredibly brittle, right? When they get compromised, they just get owned because we're very bad at notifying the user, and our systems kind of fail atomically, like an entire system fails at once. And the user generally, because the entire system fails at once, doesn't have a way of noticing and understanding what's going on. So they just, hey, maybe they notice their phone is acting funny, but maybe they just don't notice anything because the guy who wrote the malware actually knew what he was doing for once. So if you take that as one of the fundamental problems in security, well, one of the interesting things is in most situations you have an incredibly complex and very powerful pattern matching CPU hooked up to your system that you're not using. It's called the user. If you say, okay, we're going to segment this problem, you know, let's say we've got a phone. Instead of it just being a phone, I'm going to have a Wi-Fi dongle and a phone, and the Wi-Fi dongle's got some LEDs on, and one of them isn't being used for anything, and I'm going to run a firewall and a deep packet inspection tool on that Wi-Fi dongle, and if it sees anything that it thinks looks weird, it lights up an LED. And if it sees something, hey, you've got something that I think is voice traffic going out from your phone, it lights up an LED. And then you look at your phone and I'm like, wait, I'm not on a call. Why does that thing have its voice traffic LED on? And now I can do something, you know. And, you know, maybe I'm still owned. I don't know any techies. I can't really do anything. But now I know, hey, my phone is acting weird and I think it's owned. Or my Wi-Fi dongle is up. Something in this set of things is no longer acting correctly. Okay, now I can take some kind of corrective action, which is maybe I'm going to go put my phone in the fridge while we have this conversation in another room, or I'm going to leave my phone on the bus so it rides around town for a few hours while I go to the airport, or whatever, you know, whatever the situation, whatever the thing that you need to actually do is, you put the user in a place where they can affect what the outcome is for them. This is how you look at a security problem and take a theory of change and drive it all the way through. If you're not doing that and you're designing tools, you're probably wasting everyone's time. So, hacker culture is kind of at a crossroads. For a long time, it was totally cool that, you know what, I don't really want to be political because, like, I just like to reverse code, and it's a lot of fun, and I don't really have time for politics because I spend 13 hours a day looking at shell code, and socialism takes too long. So that was great for a while, but we don't get to be apolitical anymore because if you are doing security work, if you are doing development work, and you are apolitical, then you are aiding the existing centralizing structure. If you're doing security work and you're apolitical, you're almost certainly working for an organization that exists in large part to prop up existing companies and existing power structures. You know, if you work for a, you know, who here has worked for a security consultancy? Not that many people. Okay. I don't know anybody who's worked for a security consultancy where that consultancy hasn't done work for someone in the defense industry. There are probably a few, and I guarantee that every one of those consultancies that has done no work that's defense industry related has taken an active political position that we will not touch anything that's remotely fishy. If you are apolitical, you are aiding the enemy. No neutral ground means that we have to have the culture war. You know, that we have to say, you are either with us or against us. You know, you don't get to be, well, I'm, like, I guess if democracy happens to occur, I'm not against it, but I'm not, no. No. We're done. You know, there's this notion, and it's talked about in the context of harassment, that you accept what you walk by. Your standard is what you walk by. So if you see, you know, if you see somebody kind of putting somebody down, but it's like it's not a big deal, like it's whatever, it's not enough to write them up over, you walk by it, well, that's the standard of what you accept. That's your baseline. If that happens everywhere, then that's totally fine. And it will happen everywhere, because the standard is what you ignore. The standard is what you're like, oh, I don't really want to have that fight right now, and it's not that big of a deal. I'm just going to go get a beer. Yeah, that's your standard for what you accept in the world. So if you don't want to do that, then fucking speak up. This is why I was boycotting. I am still boycotting this event. I was not going to be here, and then I had a free day in Amsterdam, and Dr. Back said, well, I'll give you a stage, and you can show up and rant. So I'm here, and I'm ranting. You know, so yes, we have culture wars going on. This isn't about hacker in-group politics. The culture war is the big culture war, right? It's the fight for the narrative of what humans are. Do you believe that people are fundamentally altruistic, or do you believe that we will stab each other in the back for a loaf of bread at the moment's notice, and that if you aren't kin and kind, then, you know, fuck you, I'll stick your head up on a pike. If that's the world you want to live in, you get to choose which of those is true, right? This isn't just a war over what is true, it's a war over what we want to be true. You get to build the world you want to live in. That's what the culture war we're having right now in the hacker scene is actually about. This war has real cost. Like, this is not free, this is not easy. It has costs at many, many levels. You know, it has costs within our community, right? You know, you were talking about maybe wanting Noisy Square to become OHM next time, you know, to run the Dutch camp in 4 years. If that happens, it will probably split the Dutch scene for real. There will be two camps, and one of them may or may not happen, depending on how the funding goes. That has a real cost. It means that there will be real fights. There will be people who won't come. There are a lot of people who I wanted to see this year who decided that they really couldn't come after the behavior of the organizing committee. I miss those people. I would love to see them here. I would love to have been here the whole time. This has real costs because it's a real fight. You know, people get hurt. But it matters. You know, we don't get to say no. So back to that bit about the power of the state, back to that bit that surveillance is inevitable as long as you have a state, which it is, as long as you have the state that wants to centralize all of the power, that wants to hold on, that is going to be the single centralizing entity, you know, as long as you have empire, yes, you're going to have surveillance. It is an inherent problem in the Westphalian Compromise. you know, for a long time, it sort of, kind of, maybe worked, or we could at least pretend that it worked a little bit more easily. But the state has been captured by a lot of other centralizing structures. There's really no such thing as an independent state anymore. I mean, like, the closest you get is North Korea, which is really just a client state of the Chinese anyway. Because you don't have independent states because money has gotten into states and has, you know, global corporations and the global rich have bought those states. Now, the states also buy the global rich, right? It's this kind of mutual cancer of centralizing structures. In this context, surveillance is going to continue to be maximally deployed. And a functional public, a functional publis, a functional democracy, a functional dialogue can't happen with surveillance. You know, as soon as, you start organizing to express an opinion publicly, which is unpopular, and you get banned, you get jackboots at your door because they've heard every word that you said, or you never have the idea of organizing dissent because you live in Singapore and the brutality is right there out in the open. As long as you stay in the mall, it's cool. But if you, like, independent media, why would we have an independent media? The media exists to a certain extent. So if we want to have something that resembles democracy, given that the tactics of power and the tactics of the rich and the technology and the technological structures that we exist within have made that impossible, then we have to deal with this centralizing function. As with the internet, so the world. You know, we have to take it all apart. We have to replace these structures. And this isn't going to happen overnight, right? This is a decades-long project. We need to go build something else, right? We need to go build collective structures for discussion and decision-making and governance which don't rely on centralized power anymore. If we want to have democracy, and I'm not even talking about digital democracy, if you want to have democratic states that are actually meaningfully democratic, that is simply a requirement now. But we cannot build a free world on an unfree internet. You cannot build functionally decentralized, internet-centric, democratic structures on an unfree internet. You know, it's like the CIA trying to build a free democracy on a legacy of treachery and murder. It just doesn't work. Oh, whoops. I guess they pity about that. So, yeah. Let's fight. Mm-hmm.